Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting, a new frontrunner for Trump's Secretary of State. ExxonMobil President and CEO Rex Tillerson has emerged as President-elect Donald Trump's top choice for Secretary of State, according to two transition officials. Tillerson joins former Trump critic and 2012 Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney as the apparent leading contenders for the nation's top diplomatic post. Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani was also on Trump's shortlist before he withdrew his name from consideration Friday, citing plans to return to the private sector. Tillerson, the chief executive of the world's largest publicly traded company, has extensive international business experience, including dealings with Russia. Tillerson's involvement with Russia, including his personal ties with President Vladimir Putin, would likely draw close scrutiny during any Senate confirmation hearings, given Russia's apparent attempts to influence the outcome of November's U.S. presidential election. Tillerson met privately with the president-elect on Tuesday after recommendations from former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates. The CIA believes Russia intervened in the recent U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win at the polls. That according to an article in the Washington Post newspaper today. In the meantime, President Obama has ordered the intelligence community to conduct a full review of hacking-related activity aimed at disrupting the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Eric Schultz is the White House Deputy Press Secretary.
This is not an effort to challenge the outcome of the election. We have acknowledged who won the election. It wasn't the candidate that the president campaigned for. So we're not calling into question the election results. We are taking seriously our responsibility to protect the integrity of those elections.
This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and other top diplomats are in Paris in a fresh attempt to find solutions for Syria's nearly six-year-old war that has claimed the lives of more than 300,000 people.
The indiscriminate bombing by the regime, which violates international rules of law of war, in many cases crimes against humanity and war crimes, needs to stop. And those who support it, those in Moscow and elsewhere who have supported it, should do their utmost to bring it to a close.
The French foreign minister hosted the meeting in the French capital to discuss Syria with United States, European, and Arab top diplomats and members of Syria's opposition, a group known as the Friends of Syria. All calls for a stop to the fighting have so far failed. Mr. Kerry also took time to defend the Obama administration's fight against ISIS.
And as we begin the days of wrapping up the Obama administration, I want to make it crystal clear that we have made enormous progress in that regard. In some ways, not as fast as any of us always wanted to, but significant progress.
In the meantime, UN General Assembly also voted to pass a resolution late Friday that demanded an immediate cessation of fighting in Syria and urgent humanitarian aid access. Russia, China, and Iran voted against the resolution, which is non-binding but carries political weight. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on Saturday, touting the honor as a gift from heaven for his efforts in ending the 50-year civil war in Colombia. He said this piece of news came as a gift from heaven at a time when our ship felt adrift. The Nobel Peace Prize was the tailwind that helped us reach our destination. The Port of Peace. Thank you very much. Santos was awarded the Peace Prize for his work in brokering a peace deal between the Colombian government and leftist guerrillas of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, after decades of war. In his acceptance speech, Santos dedicated the award to all Colombians, especially those 220,000 who died during the Civil War. Countries around the world mark International Human Rights Day today. As disrespect for basic human rights continues to be widespread in many areas, the United Nations is calling on everyone to stand up for universal rights. International Human Rights Day is a commemoration of December 10, 1948, when the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga, sitting in for Peter Clote.
Those who have been assigned to handle the elections, they were very well trained.
Ghanaian President Ben Dramani Mahama concedes defeat and congratulates newly elected Nana Akufo-Addo.
All the parties were called to the IEC, I think it was on Monday, to tell them that there were errors and mistakes made, which is not from the level of the electorate, but the level of the IEC, which mistakes are unacceptable.
Calls increase for Gambian President Yahya Jammeh to accept the results of the December 1st presidential election.
We always work under pressure, my bro, you understand? It's under pressure, the target for the owner. You need a lot of money as well. I have to go home with something. I'm working with money. I cannot just go home without anything in my pocket.
And we continue with our series on road chaos in South Africa. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Ghana's president, John Mahama, conceded defeat Friday, 2 days after a hotly contested election. They were seen as a test for a country generally viewed as a beacon of stability in West Africa. Mahama called to congratulate opposition leader Nana Akufo-Addo. His supporters had already gathered outside his modest house, as media had already given him a clear lead after Wednesday's polls. Peter Clote is in Accra, Ghana, where he talked to Hifikepunye Pohamba, former president of Namibia and head of the AU Poll Observer Mission in Ghana.
It was a very good meeting. We first met before the election just to exchange the views on how we are going to observe the elections. Elections have taken place here. We felt that it's very important for us to meet again so that we can look into what had happened the day of elections. So this is what exactly what we did.
So, Mr. President, if I may ask you, you went to several polling stations to monitor and observe what went on at the polling stations. What was your experience like? And when you met and spoke with some of these presiding officers and some of the voters, what did you come up with?
Well, first, I was very much impressed. This is not my first time to observe elections, but I think those who have been assigned to handle the elections, they were very well trained. They informed me about some little problems that they encountered, especially when it comes to logistics. Materials came late, and in the afternoon when I went to check some of them, I found that they have coped up very, very well. They have attended to those, although they have had some delays. And people were very enthusiastic to vote, and I have not seen anything that disturbed me. In the contrary, I saw things that made me happy, that yes, the people of Ghana happily went to election to elect the leaders of their choice.
So, Mr. President, if I may ask you, how about the process of authenticating these voters who wanted to cast their ballot? How was the process like, and what did you observe about that?
Well, first of all, the people went to vote at the polling stations where they have registered as voters. And I saw some who came there. I think were not very well informed. They stood in the queue for a long time, only to be told when they approached the desk that this is not the right polling station. They should go to the other polling station. In this particular case, they were somehow lucky because there were more than two polling stations at the same place. So they shifted from here, went to the correct polling stations, and they voted there. So I have not seen big problems at all, I must say.
That was Hifi Pukunye Pohamba, former president of Namibia and head of the AU Poll Observer Mission. He spoke with my colleague, Peter Clote. Meanwhile, the African Union is calling on Gambian President Yahya Jammeh to accept the results of the presidential election earlier this month, as he said he would. AU Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma says the Commission strongly urges President Yahya Jammeh to facilitate a peaceful and orderly transition and transfer power to the new president of the Gambia. Jammeh had conceded defeat after the December 1st poll, but issued a statement Friday saying unacceptable errors were found by election officials and he's no longer conceding to opposition candidate Adama Barrow. Jammeh has ruled Gambia for more than 22 years. Elsewhere, several people have been killed and hundreds either arrested or missing in the capital of the northwestern region of Cameroon. This as violence escalates in the English-speaking region of the country. Parts of the population are protesting the use of French, which they say is eroding the English language. They are demanding a return to federalism, while others are asking for secession from the Republic of Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Protesters in Bamenda, capital of the northwest region of Cameroon, shout as they carry a man who was shot in the leg to the hospital. They came out to stop the ruling CPDM party and the Prime Minister of Cameroon, Philemon Yang, from organizing what they called a peace rally to stop them from protests that started last month. Yewan Petra, a resident of Bamenda, says the military shot at protesters who were hoisting blue and white flags as an indication the English-speaking regions want to separate from the French-speaking region of Cameroon.
The people of Bamenda are hoisting a flag that is not recognized. You cannot, in a nation, hoist a flag that is not recognized by the people. If it was a white flag, I would understand it is for peace. Hoisting a flag that symbolizes some kind of a secessionist attitude is going to provoke the military.
The government said two people died, but some residents and media outlets reported that there were at least seven deaths. They are protesting what they call the overbearing influence of French in the bilingual country. In 1961, people of today's northwest and southwest English-speaking regions of Cameroon voted whether to join Nigeria, which had already obtained independence from Britain, or the Republic of Cameroon, which had obtained independence from France. The vote resulted in the English-speaking regions becoming part of French-speaking Cameroon, and the country practiced a federal system of government. English and French became the official languages of Cameroon. Ebune Charles, historian at the University of Yaoundé, says since 1972, when a new constitution was adopted, replacing a federal state with a unitary state, French-speaking Cameroonians have failed to respect the linguistic and cultural nature of the minority English-speaking Cameroonians.
We were supposed to have predominantly English-speaking administrators in the predominantly English-speaking regions of the Northwest and the Southwest. That is not the case. We were expecting official documents signed in both languages. That is not the case. Presidential decrees come only in one language. If you look at the level of the military, this is where it is so scandalous. It is just in one language, but we are in a bilingual country.
Ebune says other grievances are that the country's currency is printed only in French. Notice boards, even in the English-speaking regions, are mostly in French, and more than 70% of radio and TV programs in the state media are in French. The ongoing protests were started by lawyers against the overbearing influence of the French language. They asked for French-speaking judges who are not of the common law system to be transferred out of court in the English-speaking regions, stating that justice cannot be rendered when the judge, the advocate, and the suspect cannot communicate. They also asked for the Ojada business law used by French African countries to be translated into English. When their requests were not granted, they went to the streets and refused defending clients in court. Teachers also got involved, stating there is an overbearing influence of French in schools in the English-speaking regions to the detriment of the English language, and supported the lawyers when the government failed to listen. They refused teaching. Professor George Dobgima Nyamdi, politician and former presidential aspirant, says the situation degenerated because the government has refused to listen to the cries of English-speaking Cameroonians.
At the moment we are speaking, kindergarten children are out of school. Secondary school children are out of school. University students are out of school. These are in-house problems we need to address. All those categories of people are not mad. This country needs to tell its kindergarten children why they are at home. I'm saddened, horrified, but not surprised. I'm saddened that members of our society are aggrieved. Lawyers are not attending to clients. That's the legal system being undermined. If things like this happen to a country, it means there's something fundamentally wrong that must be addressed.
As the strikes continue, with violence leading to the closure of schools, universities and markets in the English-speaking zones of Cameroon, the Catholic Church has been calling for dialogue. The Archbishop of Bamenda, Cornelius Esua Fontem, says
the Prime Minister has accepted those conditions. He is setting up a committee. He has appointed the chairperson of the committee. So why not give him a chance? There is a move of dialogue, and we should not refuse that move. We want the government to prove that they too are coherent.
It is not the first time English-speaking Cameroonians are protesting. In 1984, they created an association called the Cameroon Anglophone Movement to press for a return to the federal system, but eventually started calling for independence. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe's cross-border traders are feeling the pinch of controversial banknotes as they struggle to raise cash for restock. The notes replace US dollars, which have been used as a local currency for several years, but which are in short supply. With banks in a panic, withdrawals have been reduced to as little as $50 per day, which traders say affects their business. Martin Ngwenya reports from Gaborone, Botswana.
Elias Moyo regularly crosses into Botswana to supply veterinary medicines to some retailers in the capital, Gaborone. His business has been booming since he started operating in 2011. But he says this may be about to change with the introduction of bond notes in Zimbabwe. Traders cannot use their profits, which are in Botswana currency, even to buy gifts in Botswana to take back into Zimbabwe. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe requires that Moyo and other exporters deposit all of their foreign earnings from Botswana into a Zimbabwean account. But according to new laws, only $50 can be withdrawn per day. He argues that it is hardly enough for him to buy stock to meet the demands of his customers. Moyo says government is robbing them because they cannot immediately withdraw the money they've just deposited. We must deposit the money into the bank the moment we come back into the country. But after that, we can only withdraw $50 per day, which is not enough for our customers' order. As a result, we are losing a lot of business. Another cross-border trader, 35-year-old Ms. Shingai Mpofu, says bond notes spell doom for their trade. Mpofu is a qualified teacher pushed into trading by scarce employment opportunities in Zimbabwe. She sells various domestic wares at the Gaborone bus rank. Like Moyo, she says business has taken a knock over the last few months, and in her view, the introduction of bond notes compounds an already volatile trading environment. This after government banned the import of some goods this year.
I used to make enough to feed my family back home, but these days with the cash unavailable in Zimbabwe, I hardly have enough to restock. I make fewer trips, which means less money, and the little that we make in Botswana, we cannot take groceries home due to the recent import ban.
A Zimbabwean economic analyst based in Hauroni, Joram Monashe, says the absence of real cash, like dollars, means there are no transactions. Monashe says to make things worse, transferring money out of Zimbabwe is prohibited. It's an effort by the government to end a problem that became obvious last year when Zimbabwean companies and citizens sent nearly $2 billion to overseas accounts.
Considering the high unemployment rate in Zimbabwe, you find that a lot of people are actually surviving on cross-border trade. And with the new limitations that are coming in from the Reserve Bank and the issuing of the bond notes, which is, we have all been told that you can only use them in Zimbabwe, is going to compound problems for the cross-border traders.
Zimbabweans have been anxious since the government announced its intention last May to introduce bond notes to ease growing cash shortages. Critics argue that consumers will not be able to purchase needed food imports. They also say the notes, similar to a failed currency plan 7 years ago, could lead to hyperinflation. That would be the nail, they say, in the coffin of an already ailing economy. Reporting for Voice of America's English to Africa service, this is Martin Gwenya in Hauron, Botswana.
New York City is both a world of cultural capital and a global market magnet for immigrants. That's why in New York, the term culture includes an abundance of art at museums, galleries, theaters, and concert halls, as well as hundreds of grassroots venues and immigrant neighborhoods. To find out more how New York City's government reaches out to the African diaspora and showcases its many cultures, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Tom Finkapel, New York's Commissioner of Cultural Affairs.
This administration is quite focused on equity and connecting with different communities in the city. So, you know, the cultural life of New York City includes everything from painting and sculpture and performances, but also stuff, what happens on the streets. There's also the for-profit art world, like the music clubs or the Broadway theater, etc. So it's a very broad definition of culture.
To what extent do you reach out to immigrant communities, especially perhaps the African diaspora and other kinds of places, in terms of offering them the cultural riches of New York, sort of generally understood?
So you have this incredible stream of people coming into the city. I've been up to the Bronx a number of times, and there are certain places where, you know, there are large concentrations of African immigrants. And it's been very difficult, actually, for us to connect to the incredible cultural life of those communities. A lot of communities that are very new are focusing on sort of getting their feet on the ground and maybe doing cultural activity within the community, not so much connecting yet to other communities. You know, we do focus a lot on trying to understand who works at cultural institutions. We did a diversity survey, which showed that the cultural workforce is not nearly as diverse as the city itself. I mean, there are very few African folks in positions of power. I'm talking about curators and directors of institutions, because I feel like once you get very diverse staff in terms of those positions, all the other kinds of diversity flow. You'll have a diverse audience.
What about showcasing the natural cultural riches of immigrant communities to your generic culturally interested New Yorker? I mean, so that they do get to see the African dancing or the samba or whatever.
There are some opportunities already in New York City for people to encounter African culture, but I don't think it's enough. And I think that there's a much richer array of offerings, let's say, for Asian artists right now in New York City. Obviously, there's a very large African-American population. So there is, for example, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music once a year, a dance festival that includes quite a bit of African dance as well, right? So there's an audience already in place, and there's certain places you can study African dance. There's a place in the North Bronx that I know of that really is quite good at that. So we do fund it. We give them a lot of capital money to rebuild the facility. That building is filled with really good African art. So it's not that it's not there. It's that it's not as much of the flow of cultural resources as I think it probably should be to really enrich everybody's life.
sounds like you might have sort of a double mandate. You want to enrich everybody's life in New York by exposing them to these wonders of immigrant life. And at the same time, you want to celebrate culture so that people know what's going on in their own community. People might not go up to Highbridge in the Bronx, where a lot of Ghanaians live, but the Ghanaians sure do.
Yeah, people want a rich cultural life in their own community, and they want to get out of their community to see other communities.
What efforts do you make to get generic West African or Nigerian to the Mets of the world and the Frick Collection, for example, or the Brooklyn Museum? How does that work?
You know, we're a funding agency, so we actually don't do programs, we fund programs. And the Met does a very good job in natural history in these big museums of getting school groups, for example, from the entire city in there. You know, there's a great African art collection at the Met, and so it's important for kids of all stripes to see it. I think it might be particularly important for kids from African immigrant families to come and see that they are represented right in the center of the most important or the largest art museum in America. And I want my kid to be exposed to great African art. I want African kids to be exposed to that and to European art. Art is for everybody.
That was Tom Finkerpaul, Commissioner of New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Now in South Africa, minibus taxis are the scourge of the roads. The taxi operators usually drive extremely recklessly, ignoring traffic rules. The country's impoverished masses are forced to use the vehicles because they can't afford more expensive transport. Every year, thousands of people are killed in minibus taxi crashes. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor explores why the taxi drivers feel compelled to drive so dangerously.
Home Sweet Home reads the sticker on the minibus taxi's back windscreen as it speeds through a red traffic light in the Johannesburg city centre. At the wheel is Tumi Modiba, a jovial 28-year-old with a sparkling gap-toothed smile. Kill them with success, say the bright red letters on his blue t-shirt. Modiba drives on sidewalks, in bus lanes, and on the wrong side of the road. His taxi is packed with 22 people. It's supposed to carry only 16. No one wears a seatbelt. Modiba maintains that minibus taxi drivers have no choice but to disobey traffic laws.
Time. Time is money, my bro.
We always work under pressure, my bro, you understand? It's under pressure, the target for the owner. You need a lot of money as well. I have to go home with something. I'm working with money. I cannot just go home without anything in my pocket. You understand? It's really frustrating, I'm telling you.
Taxi drivers don't get fixed salaries. They work on commission. The more passengers they ferry, the more trips they make, the more money the taxi owners pay them. People give Modiba 14 rands, less than $1, to transport them from northern Johannesburg to the city. To satisfy the owner of the taxi he drives, Modiba must make at least 7,000 rands, about $500 a week.
If I don't make that target, they'll definitely tell me, hey boy, get out of my car, I'll find another driver. That's the pressure as well. So I have to make that money for him to be happy.
If he makes his target, says Modiba, the owner pays him 1,500 rands, less than $100 a week. He, his unemployed wife, and two toddler sons must survive on this. Modiba works 6 days a week, sometimes seven. He starts driving at 5 in the morning and usually stops at 8 at night. Modiba argues with another taxi operator about who's first in the queue to load passengers. He says the life of a taxi driver is filled with stress as they battle each other to make their quotas. They're under constant pressure to transport as many passengers as fast as possible so they don't lose their jobs. Because of this, says Modiba, they break all the rules of the road. Modiba hoots to attract customers. He says every day is a race to survive, a race to beat other taxis to the people lining the city roads.
It's like competition in the road. Like now, I'm following this car. I have to be back before this car so that I can make a lot of money as well.
In his quest to make as much money as possible and to save as much time as possible, Modiba runs red light after red light.
Before I do go through that red light, I observe first. Is it safe for me to do so?
He talks a lot on his phone while driving. He says he mostly speaks to other drivers.
Sorry for that hiccup, but that was Darren Taylor reporting from Johannesburg. You're listening to VOA, and this is Nightline Africa. And see to come Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Yes, it's that time for our Saturday music spot. Time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa. Here we go.
Now we know baby matter daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now we don't talk to butter. Family they smile and we know get quanta. That we just say Yoruba, make them no go forget say Badona Baba. Eruku de Fiaka. And the time is the money.
Biko ye meko. Ori mi jeki jeki lo. Life is all about the money. Yeah.
Every day we go to jolly. jolly. Every day we go dey jolly, we go dey jolly. Yeah, yeah.
Every day I wake up, every day I dey see food to chop. Every day when I dey go to work, I beg the Lord, yeah. Every day is the same, Baba God no be my way to change. Oh yeah, count your blessings every day. I go dey praise you, my Baba God, cause you be the one way to take care of me. You know dey for my hand when I call you, you be the best daddy, my daddy.
If you know the God, I know if they are alive. One day be a no rule. If you know be God to you, I know if they are alive for you. One day be a no rule. Every day we go to jolly. Every day we go to jolly. Every day we go to jolly. We go to jolly. Yeah. Every day we go to jolly. Every day we go to jolly. Every day we go to jolly. We go to jolly.
Negro, negro, negro.
alelele mama amala la lelele o shake it for Africa, eh, do it for Africa amama mama o lelele mama o shake it for Africa, oh yeah, rise up and stand up for Africa.
See the whole world be looking at us, yeah, cause our land is honey, all the future money. And see now, see I get you my
they tell you say na you. Go be my persona, baby. Hey, hey. Go be my persona, sissy.
I'm kind of in bed, and you can say,
And that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight. I'll see you tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to helping the Democratic Republic of the Congo find a peaceful way forward after President Joseph Kabila's second term in office ends on December 19th. On October 18th, the government concluded an agreement with several opposition groups facilitated by the African Union that calls for elections in April of 2018. The October 18th agreement was a step in the right direction, but its timeline for holding elections fails to meet the legitimate aspirations of the people of the DRC. In addition, important parts of the opposition did not take part in the discussions that led to the agreement. The highly respected DRC's Conference of Catholic Bishops, or CENCO, is leading further discussions in pursuit of a more inclusive and strengthened agreement on the electoral calendar and transfer of power. The United States strongly supports CENCO in this role, given its credibility and neutrality, and believes its efforts provide the best chance of reaching a consensus agreement and guaranteeing the holding of elections. Supporting CENCO's efforts is our top priority, said U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa, Tom Perriello, recently. I believe there is still a window for the bishops to succeed. U.S. government officials are in near constant contact with stakeholders, including within the DRC government and the opposition, pressing them to work with CENCO in good faith and to prioritize consensus over individual or party gain. The U.S. strongly believes that the key elements in an agreement likely to attract consensus include an electoral timeline that calls for presidential elections in 2017, a guarantee that the Constitution will not be amended and that President Kabila will not seek a third term, and electoral safeguards to ensure a free and fair election, including impartial Electoral Commission leadership. The United States will continue to support efforts to advance democracy, stability, and prosperity for the people of the DRC.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.